In the KSRO kitchen, I'm Steve Garner, along with Chef John Ash. Good morning, John Ash.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm doing well on a beautiful spring day here in Sonoma County, mid-70s. We will chat with our special guest in the KSRO kitchen today, and that's Dr. Ali Bazzari. Good morning, Doctor.
Good morning.
Nice to see you this morning. Before we do any of that, John, this past week, mentioned to me, it was, you know, what's really the deal with kosher wines? Passover's coming up next weekend.
Yeah.
And you see them in the store, and you just, everything's got a kosher label on it nowadays, right? From Fritos to Manischewitz, obviously the one sweet kosher wine that most people might know about.
Yeah.
So we thought we would enlist an expert, and that's Jeff Morgan. Jeff is a co-owner of Covenant Winery. It's an urban winery in Berkeley that actually has a tasting room, and he makes wines there. And he's had a lifetime of experience working with kosher wines. He was the wine writer for the Wine Spectator in the 1990s. He wrote about kosher wines. And we thought maybe in just a few minutes he could demystify what they are. And actually my specific question was, what's the difference between kosher wines and these kosher for Passover wines? Is there some science behind it, or is there just more of a mystical?
So let me throw in one other quick question.
Yes.
And are kosher wines good?
And are they good?
Yeah.
And we see some in the store.
Yeah.
But a Covenant is one that we're familiar with, and we know that there is some availability in Sonoma County. So Jeff, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks for having me on the show, guys. It's great to be here.
All right, so go ahead.
Can I answer a couple of these questions real quickly?
Sure.
They're great questions, and they're really simple. First of all, is kosher wine good? Well, you all live in the wine country, and you know that there are lots of really good wines, lots of really bad wines, although not as many as there used to be, and lots of in-between wines. It's the same thing with kosher wine. It's there's good, bad, and ugly, and hopefully there's more good out there. But really, what makes a wine kosher is probably the next question we need to answer, and that is nothing in particular except who touches it. It's a symbolic designation. Really, there's no kosher method. My wines at Covenant, which we make, as you said, in Berkeley from Sonoma grapes and Napa grapes and Lodi grapes, are all made with native yeast fermentations. Most of my wines are unfined and unfiltered. And if they weren't kosher, I'd make them exactly the same way. So, what is it that keeps them kosher? Well, it's a tradition, and that is it's been around for 2,500, 3,000 years. That because the wine is used to sanctify the Sabbath. In other words, it's the first prayer we say on Friday night to bring in the Sabbath, which is Friday night, Saturday. The wine is considered kind of a special conduit to God, and so. We like to make sure that it's only handled by Jews who are Sabbath observant. In other words, Jews who only eat kosher food, Jews who don't work on the Sabbath, and follow all the other rules that most of us Jews don't follow. So in my cellar, in my wine cellar, where we're, you know, I have three guys, three production guys, and each one of them is a little more religious than I am. They wouldn't talk on the telephone on Saturday. They don't work on Saturday. The winery's closed on Saturday, which is the Sabbath, and other Jewish holidays. But that's it. I mean, that's the only requirement. Who touches the wine? The rest of it is, I don't know, there's no rabbi that has to bless it. There's no rabbi that needs to oversee it. This is kind of, these are all wives' tales that really have nothing to do with reality. Now, what is the difference between kosher for Passover wine and kosher wine? Well, essentially, for Passover, there's certain foods that we're not supposed to eat, like bread or leavened bread. So, you know, we don't use any, we don't typically use flour in bread flour in our winemaking. So, really, there's almost nothing you could do to make a wine that wasn't kosher for Passover, but it would be kind of like making sparkling wine or champagne for New Year's that didn't have any bubbles. I mean, you have to be crazy to make a wine that wasn't kosher for Passover, because that's the biggest sales time of the year for us. When it's Passover, you got to have 4 cups of wine for the Passover Seder. It's like, it's the one time of the year when everybody's really mandated to drink a lot of wine, except maybe for Purim, which came just a few weeks ago. So I hope I've clarified. Basically, there's nothing in particular that makes a wine kosher in terms of the way it's made, aside from who touches it.
So to use the kosher symbol, you can just do it. You don't have to get.
Well, you can't just do it. No, it's the kosher symbol, like the one that you see on, you know, Lay's potato chips or Coca-Cola or whatever. One of the most common symbols is the U with the circle around it. That's OU. That stands for the Orthodox Union or the Union of Orthodox Rabbis based in New York. It's a kosher certifying agency, just like if you were making organic, if you had an organic vineyard, you wanted to be certified. There are organic certifying agencies that you would have to apply to, and then they have their rules, and they have to make sure you're following their rules to give you the certification. It's the same thing for the little symbol there for the OU. They just have to make sure that you're doing it their way, which would mean only having a Sabbath observant Jews, you know, handling the wine, for example. That's kind of the biggest requirement. And then, yeah, you might not. I mean, some fining agents, for example, that we use in winemaking, like Isinglass is made from the bladder of sturgeon. Sturgeon's not considered a particularly kosher fish. So we don't fine any of our wines anyway, so it's not an issue. But if you were making kosher wine, you'd have to use a different fining agent that was a certified kosher. Same with yeast. We don't use any yeast. We don't use any. We use only native yeast. So, but if you were going to inoculate with yeast, you'd have to buy commercial yeast that had a little symbol on it that assured the OU or the certifying agency that the yeast were made in a lab that was kosher, cleanly, or whatever.
So does your wine have a K or an OU on the label?
Yeah, we got the OU, and it says OUP, which means it's kosher for Passover. And then we got another one from another rabbi. Just in case the OU is not good enough for anybody listening, we have Rabbi Babad, the Tartakova Rav, who lives in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, who comes out and says hi to us once or twice a year because he kind of believes in us, and he gives us his certification as well.
Wow, that's
holy
a lot.
Yeah, that's
but,
great.
But you won't see on my labels anywhere kosher. There's nothing that says kosher in English. There's nothing that says kosher in Hebrew either. It the only way you would know that our wines are kosher is by that little certification. Uh-huh. Two little certifications we have. And by the way, you know our wines are on lots of non-kosher wine lists. For example, I have four wines on the list at the French Laundry. And I have wines on the list at Probaco in the city and Michael Mina and in great restaurants in New York as well. Also all over the world, as a matter of fact. Our wines are poured in lots of great non-kosher restaurants. We make the whole point of Covenant, and when we started, you know, back in 2003, was simply to make great wine that happened to be kosher. That was the goal. Okay. And today I hope we've succeeded, and I think we've inspired a lot of other fine wineries around the world to do the same. There's lots of good kosher wine out there today.
One wine shop in Sonoma County does carry your wines, and that's Sonoma Wine Shop, mm-hmm. and also the Bodega Wine Shop on Gravenstein Highway in Sebastopol. Mm-hmm. And they carry, you have some very clever names for your wines, I have to tell you. One is called Tribe, which is the red blend. And then there's Mensch, which is a Yiddish word for a grown-up, which is a white wine. And then Red Sea, and that's not S-E-A, it's the letter C, Red Sea, a Cabernet blended Sauvignon Blanc. And there's a Covenant Chardonnay, which is actually, I learned the grapes come from Sonoma Mountain over in Glen Ellen. And those wine shops, both in Sebastopol and Sonoma, carry those wines. And they're going to be actually doing a couple Passover Seders on Friday and Saturday, and also they're doing an Easter brunch. So they're covering everything next week, and you can go to their website and find out about what those meals are. The menus are online. Now, before we let you go, people can take tours of your operation. Is that right, Jeff?
So our winery, we're the largest winery in the East Bay, I think, at the moment, or one of the largest. We have 7,000 square feet of kosher winemaking heaven. Open for tours and tastings. We're at 1102 6th Street, which is just off the Gilman Street exit. It's the first exit when you get off 80 and you hit the East Bay in Berkeley. And we have a website, covenantwines.com, where you can make an appointment. We're a kind of a lean team, so we'd like to know you're coming, just so we make sure somebody is available to give you that tasting in our little tasting room. But we would love to have people come visit us and show you what we're doing in Berkeley. We also make wine in Israel, believe it or not, and our Israeli wines are also on display at the winery and for sale in various shops around the Bay Area as well.
Thanks for educating us this morning. Jeff Morgan of Covenant Wine, have a blessed and joyful Passover.
Thank you for having me on the show.
Our pleasure. Jeff Morgan from Covenant Winery in Berkeley. We'll take a break and come back and talk with Ali Bazzari, our culinary biochemist, PhD wizardry of food and all that entails. Chef John Ash and Steve Garner in the KS Ordo Kitchen.
Sonoma County's local news, weather, and traffic station, FM News Talk, KSRO, 103.5, 94.5.
DJ Sash and Glass is a full-service windows and glass family business that has served Sonoma County since 1960. DJ's makes it easy to replace your old, drafty, hard-to-open windows. Improve the look and value of your home with reliable, energy-efficient Milgard replacement windows. You don't have to worry about disposing of your old windows. DJ Sash and Glass makes it easy to get your home improvement project done. And shower doors and enclosures are just a phone call away at DJ Sash and Glass. DJ specializes in custom shower doors and custom mirrors for your new or replacement bathroom project. Call DJ Sash and Glass today for windows and your shower door replacement. Add a touch of class to your glass with DJ Sash and Glass. 2985 Wilgin Court. Call 546-7344 and online at djsglass.com.
Hi, this is Nate Bauer with Professional Marketing Group North Bay, better known as PMG. I'd like to personally invite you to our annual marketing conference on putting education and self-reflection designed to improve and elevate your marketing strategy. Get access to years of experience from industry experts in business development, cognitive science, creative design, and team dynamics. This year's conference welcomes Brian J. Weller, Hobie Wedler, Laurel Gregory, and Tom Mitchell for an in-depth analysis, workshop, and inspirational journey to discover the next chapter in your marketing success. Reserve your spot today at pmgnorthbay.org. That's pmgnorthbay.org. It's PMG's Ahead of the Curve Marketing Conference, Thursday, April 25th at Foxtail Golf Club in Roanoke Park. Your next move is just a day away from greatness. Visit pmgnorthbay.org for more information. pmgnorthbay.org. I'll see you there.
You can find the best deals in Sonoma County only on mysonomadeals.com. Enjoy dining, family fun, health and beauty, and more for just half the price. The deals are always changing in a limited quantity, so make sure to check often so you don't miss out on these amazing deals. Savings and fun, all wrapped into one, only at mysonomadeals.com. That's mysonomadeals.com.
Hi, my name's Ken, and I own Good Start Packaging in Bedford, New Hampshire. With my Spark Cash Card from Capital One, I earn unlimited 2% cash back on all my business purchases. And last year, that added up to $36,000 in cash back. That's right, $36,000. Thanks to that, I was able to offer healthcare to my employees. The Spark Cash Card did a lot for my business. Imagine what it could do for yours. What's in your wallet?
Real Capital One customers paid for real stories. Credit approval required.
KSRO, AM, FM, and online. Depend on it.
We're going to embark on a wonderful, far-ranging conversation with Dr. Ali Bazzari. This will be, I think, our third visit with Ali, going back to 2016 when we had him on for his debut cookbook, Ingredient, Unveiling the Essential Elements of Food, from 2016, which won an IACP Julia Child Culinary Award for Best Technical Reference Book. Dr. Ali Bazzari is Chief Science Officer and co-founder of Pilot R&D, that's Research and Development, did his undergraduate work in biochemistry, PhD in food biochemistry from the University of California. I also taught at the Culinary Institute of America. And I think am I correct that your research paper was on potatoes? Is that correct? Am I?
Yeah, that was my my doctoral dissertation was 350 something pages on how to make mashed potatoes good.
Really?
Yeah.
There's that much to it?
They give you a PhD for that.
Yeah, yeah.
And you write a wonderful column in the San Francisco Chronicle.
Well, thank you so much. That's that is to date my favorite writing project I've ever gotten to do.
So since we were talking about kosher wines and all of that stuff, you mentioned that in your youth, you worked in a kosher caterer.
That was my first professional cooking gig, was in high school. I was tired of being a host at a breakfast restaurant. And so I wanted to get something where I could like hold a knife and start to learn to cook. And it was an Orthodox caterer called Cohen's Cuisine in Denver, Colorado. And the proprietor was a CIA Hyde Park grad. And so he taught me a lot of great like fundamental knife skills. And then I made a lot of whipped cream by hand on the Sabbath.
Because you could not use electrical appliances.
Right, which if the spirit of that is trying to rest and be mindful, whipping, you know, quarts of whipped cream by hand is not particularly restful.
No, that's a lot of work.
So there was a lot of extra steps and a lot of protocols in a kosher catering
operation. Gosh, just the infrastructure alone. When you look at any caterer, they usually have stacks and stacks of equipment and plateware and anything they could need for a wedding or somebody's birthday party. And then multiply that by four or five, and that's what you get at a really rigorous kosher caterer for keeping everything separate, keeping everything clean. It was an amazing logistical undertaking.
So we were talking off the air about the, I don't know whether validity is the right word, of kosher, of koshering and all of that kind of stuff. And you were saying that it's so rooted in kind of ancient
best practices.
Yes, practices. And the whole reason, for example, not to eat pork was that, as you said,
parasites were rampant. It's not just with kosher methodologies and customs, but so many ancient food ways and food traditions. We tend to either say, oh, this is really important because it's traditional and know your roots, but never really explaining why that's important. Or we hand wave and we say, oh, those are wives' tales or whatever. But there's usually so much grounding. There's usually so much actual physical basis for why something is true.
Mm-hmm. But times are different now.
But so physics hasn't changed.
Yeah, but you can eat pork now. I mean, and not worry about getting parasites.
One could, but even still, when there's wild boar on the menu, that's always something to worry about. Be mindful of. I guess bear is actually the new pig. Mm-hmm. Bear is the most parasite ridden kind of meat you can eat.
Yeah, why would you want to eat it?
I don't know. A lot of people do. I have not had the pleasure.
But. You know, in one of your columns for the Chronicle, you talked a little bit about, and I'd be interested in your reaction to that, about authenticity and how. And this discussion we're having is kind of about authenticity.
Yeah, that was the Mr. Jews column about Brandon Jew and his amazing crew cooking. I don't know, the food that a person who worked in Western European restaurants and is currently in San Francisco and is of Cantonese descent, whatever you would call that food. And yeah, some of the early reviews of the restaurant were glowing. They said, this is incredible food, but I don't know where it lies in terms of authentic Chinese food. And he and I had a impassioned discussion around that of like, where is the basis for that? If food is this ever-changing thing, and with the seasons that change, and with trends that come in and out of fashion, and with economic shifts and agricultural progress, and all of these things that are constantly changing, why is it that we choose Italian food of the 1940s and Chinese food of the 1960s as these like crystallized snapshots of, oh, okay, that is authentic, or that is traditional. Maybe what is authentic is more doing things with proper intention, which is another kind of buzzword that gets thrown around by chefs. But it's every choice that a chef makes of what shape to cut a vegetable into, what kind of liquid to cook it in, how long to cook it, how to present it, what temperature to serve it. Those are all little bits and pieces of that chef's mindset and soul that are shining through. And putting something on a plate because you think it'll capture social media attention is maybe less less traditionally of a pure idealistic mm-hmm. kind of idea as something else, but it still is part of who that chef is. And so the term authenticity to me is completely meaningless. Mm. And I mean, there are things that can be cynical, mm-hmm. but why are we comparing something to some arbitrary single moment in the arc of an entire food culture?
And Mr. Jew's great restaurant to dine in San Francisco. I know the article that you had demystified whipped honey in that article.
Mm-hmm.
That was one. And then sizzling rice soup was another one that what went into both of those dishes was remarkable. And that's what you do in that house-made column in the Chronicle. You go into the restaurant kitchens and look at the techniques involved in creating these dishes.
Yeah, the idea is to go deeper than you would get either reading a review, where a reviewer, in the best scenario, will eloquently take you on a journey through what it's like to eat at the restaurant, or on a menu, it'll tell you usually what ingredients are in a dish. This is trying to tell you how that dish works, what makes it amazing, and how all of these hours of human virtuosity and inspiration and sometimes evolution and agriculture, how all mm-hmm. of the moving pieces came together to make that sizzling rice soup or make that potato pancake or make that cup of coffee.
One of the things you do, which I just love, is you'll have a recipe. Mm-hmm. So the column will begin with the recipe, which is simple. And I mean, something like sizzling rice soup is, mm-hmm. in theory, a simple dish.
Yeah, make broth, dehydrate rice, fry it, get it really hot, and drop it into the broth.
Yeah, yeah. And then you go into, oh, no.
Yeah, and then it's like 1,500 words of all of everything goes into it.
There's a lot involved. I just want to back up a bit because we missed this part. During the break, you talked about on your honeymoon, you spent it in Budapest, and we were talking about kosher foods and great Jewish cuisine, and you had a wonderful dish in Budapest.
We had cholent.
What is cholent?
It's, you can probably tell me more with historical affiliation than I could, but it's a stew that was prepared the night before the Sabbath, mm-hmm. so that it's something that could just ride and not need a lot of manipulation. It was, crock pot food. It was exactly. Slow cooker food usually had some sort of lean meat that would become tender over time. It would have some sort of legume. It was some hearty food.
I mean, for all that fancy dining that you could have done on a honeymoon, that this stood out in your mind of something that was so soul satisfying.
Yeah, I mean, we were in Budapest, Prague, and Vienna, and I'd never been to Central Europe before, especially in the dead of winter. And the two big takeaways were they have better coffee than we do, mm-hmm. and it's $2 for a cappuccino. Mm-hmm. It is a land of food in bowls, and that was amazing. That was so cool to see all of these different stews and porridges, and they're not all heavy. Mm-hmm. Just because something is soupy does not mean it needs to be hearty and heavy. And it was amazing.
Were they pretty? Because I know you're
the food the destinations.
No. Well, the destinations were beautiful, but you often think about, well, it's a bowl of brown stuff, and.
We could talk about that for like 5 hours.
Yeah.
But there is, one of my best friends is a chef. He's one of the sous chefs up at Single Thread here in Healdsburg. His name is Sean McGay. He was one of my first chefs that I was working for when we were both cooking back in Denver after the catering company. And he and I would spend a lot of time talking about the difference between something that looks natural and something that looks messy. And at the time, we were both adolescent, early 20-somethings American guys. And we would talk about how it's kind of like doing your hair in the morning, where you want it to look, put enough together that you could be in a professional place of work and look respectable, but you want it to look artfully disheveled enough to where you don't seem uptight. And that kind of, I swear this is going somewhere, that kind of applies to so much natural-looking food, where you can have a bowl of coarsely cut root vegetables and a braised lamb shank and a ton of paprika, and it doesn't look right angly and white tablecloth Michelin star, but you can still tell that there was thought that went into it and that it didn't just come out of one ladle dump. There's something intangible there, and that's something maybe for like a art design master's thesis or something, where you can talk about whether it's symmetry cues or it's something about ratio, just things can look right. And I think we see that in every avenue of life, and Central European homey rustic food as well can have that.
Take a break at that point, come back with Dr. Ali Bazzari and get into his housemaid columns starting back from November of last year. We'll go through the four that we have not had a chance to talk about since we last visited with Ali back in September of last year. Steve Garner along with Chef John Ash in the KSRO kitchen.
Join the switch to crystal clear KSRO FM, 103.5 Santa Rosa, Windsor, 94.5 Petaluma. Hear the difference.
Home. It's your retreat, especially at this time of the year when all you want to do is get out of the cold and into your comfy place. I'm Pat Kerrigan. That's why I invited Henry Mechanical into my home to see what they could do about some heating issues I had. You don't really know a company until you've seen them in action. 2 hours later, a years-old problem with my heating system was solved. Comfort returned. Ask Henry Mechanical about their Mitsubishi-zoned comfort solutions. It could save you from a temperature drop when you head to the back of the house. Mitsubishi-zoned comfort solutions, one of the ways that Henry Mechanical employs to make sure your home system is perfect for you. Installing a new heating system or fixing the one you have can be a dirty business. Not with these guys. They're prompt, polite, clean, and professional. Who can you trust your comfort to? Henry Mechanical, a local business that's in the business of your comfort. Call 707-838-3311 or visit henrymechanical.com.
Come to the Santa Rosa Original Certified Farmers Market, voted best farmers market. Find a wide selection of garden starts, savor farm fresh eggs and produce like fresh strawberries, avocados, and asparagus. Enjoy farm-to-table almonds, walnuts, and healthy salad greens. Discover quality beef, pork, fresh seafood, and freshly made sausages. Multiple food vendors are serving up an excellent breakfast and lunch using farm-fresh products. Minhee's Korean Cuisine, The Green Grocer, Mi Fiesta's Fresh Tamales, and a whole lot more. Santa Rosa's original farmers market at the Luther Burbank Center for the Arts is open year-round Wednesdays and Saturdays, 8:30 a.m. to 1 p.m. Thank you, Sonoma County, for voting them number one. The Santa Rosa Original Certified Farmers Market, where it's always fresh, local, and fun.
Have you and the family talked about hitting the highway and taking that dream vacation? A weekend getaway to the mountains or the coast? Santa Rosa RV has been making those dreams come true since 1992. Santa Rosa RV puts their customers first and foremost with a no-pressure, relaxed experience while looking for their new or pre-owned recreational vehicle. Quality brands like Rockwood, Grand Design, R-Pod, and KZ is what you'll find at Santa Rosa RV. Go to SantaRosaRVSales.com and make that dream come true.
Right now, Spring Black Friday savings at the Home Depot means more power for less paycheck. Save up to $50 on all Ryobi 40-volt cordless outdoor power equipment. The power of gas without the gas. Enough power to get the whole job done. Plus, right now, it's also the power of 50 bucks in your pocket. So cut the cord, but keep the power. Today is the day for doing. With up to $50 off all Ryobi 40-volt cordless products. Only at the Home Depot. More saving. More doing. While supplies last.
With Sonoma County's most accurate, most dependable forecast, here's Daniel Trucios on the KSRO Weather Watch.
Mostly sunny today, high 73. A few clouds, though, on the coast at 63. Partly cloudy for tonight, low 46, 48 on the shores. Tomorrow, mainly cloudy at 69, just under 60 in Bodega Bay. Monday, then, a quarter of an inch of rain expected. Temps drop to the 50s. Depend on weather every 30 minutes on FM News Talk 103.5 and 94.5 KSRO.
In the KSRO kitchen, Steve Garner along with Chef John Ash, delighted on this beautiful Saturday, April 13th, to have live in the studio Dr. Ali Bazzari. He's a culinary scientist. He is the co-founder of Pilot R&D and writes the Housemaid column in the San Francisco Chronicle. We'll go through some of those columns that we've missed since his last visit in September of 2018. But we want to know everything you've been involved in. What have you been writing the past 4 to 6 months? Tell us about it.
Well, there's always a new housemaid column every month.
When does it come out? Just for so people know, or does it at various times?
It varies. Yeah, it depends because we're scheduling time to get in.
And that's in the Sunday Chronicle.
Exactly, and Sunday Chronicle, and then
what's
online.
The next one going to be about?
The next one's going to be about coffee. And it's going to be just a deep dive into roasting and brewing and serving. And without giving too much away, coffee is one of these really fun industries where there's been a lot of dogma that has developed. I think it's just because people ran out of new things to say. Because you look at like what a chef can do in a restaurant. You have access to hundreds of ingredients that can become millions of combinations of things for a dish. In coffee or wine or even like cheese, that's where you get some of these more outlandish descriptions and conversations and people talking about these textures and things because you have to fill dead air. You have to fill airtime to talk about those things. And so the coffee maker that I'm going to be talking to for this next housemaid is somebody with much more straightforward take on why she does what she does, okay. Why she makes the decisions that she makes in roasting coffee. And I found it a lot easier to dig in with her into the science of why this stuff works because she didn't shroud herself in these layers of veils of just industry mumbo jumbo. She was like, I do this because it tastes this way.
So is terroir the place that the coffee comes from? That's important.
Oh, totally. And terroir is exactly this.
Yeah.
Terroir should be a very straightforward concept, but it's something that has gotten hijacked to sell wine. Okay. The idea of terroir for anything, coffee, wine, sauerkraut, is that you grow stuff in the ground. What is in the ground will affect the library of sugars and proteins and carbohydrates and whatever the food is made of. And those things will then break down in different ways, depending on how hot it is in the room, what microbes are around, and who's touching it.
So I have a question. We did a show recently on bagels, and there was this whole discussion about, well, the reason you can't have good bagels in the West, on the West Coast, is it's the water in New York that make. Is that true?
Oh, man. that's big water trying to push its agenda. It is true to some extent. So the Reader's Digest version is it all comes down to minerals. I mean, we talked about this in the book, but in this minerals chapter, one of the things minerals can do is they can bind structures together. So carbohydrates and proteins, those are the structure makers in food, and minerals can rivet them together so that you have a pickle with calcium in the brine will stay crispier for longer. A bread or a bagel that has a bunch of calcium and magnesium and these minerals in them will tend to be a little bit tougher. And New York municipal water has naturally low concentrations of those minerals. And so it is true that municipal water source lends itself to making more tender bagels. Mm. But it is also true that we invented water filters a very long time ago. And so there's always a story of some crazy person in Portland like tankering Lower East Side Manhattan water out to the West Coast instead of spending like $40 on an in-house filter. And that's kind of the part where you can get 5% of the science and then run with it and slather a bunch of marketing on it, or you could save your money and make great bagels.
Well answered. There's a seminar that's open to the public this coming Tuesday that you're speaking at in San Francisco. Tell us about it.
Yeah, so that's it's called Articulate. It is a food robotics summit. And that is a phrase that I'm sure raises a lot of hackles for people, especially the like, there is just one, I think there's a gene that manifests in every generation of whoever it was that got mad when Bob Dylan picked up an electric guitar. It's just that person over and over again in every generation. And I see where one is coming from. I see how automation and technology and bringing machines closer to man could be misused and could result in things that feel less soulful and special. But just like an electric guitar, just like the microphones that we're speaking to people through right now, they can be an instrument for extending people's creativity and lengthening their creative antenna. And so one of the things that I want to talk about with food robotics, because I am not a roboticist, I'm very bad with everything mechanical. is to talk about the food and the fact that we can have really wild ideas and we can say really inspirational things from the stage at TED summits, but food is dumb and food is cumbersome. And food is going to continue to be made of the same like eight fundamental building blocks, regardless of what flashy stuff we put around it. And so the way to make the best automated food, the best kinds of food that interact with robots, is to better understand the food itself and instill an understanding and empathy with how food behaves in the brilliant engineers and roboticists who might one day figure out cool things to do with it.
But aren't you flying in the face of the whole handmade hand, you know, the importance of the individual, the soul of the food comes from the fact that it's touched by
it could. Mm-hmm. One of the things I will always say is a microcosm of this was like when water bath and precision temperature cooking came about. When I first started at CIA teaching at Greystone, about half the chefs I introduced myself to, the other professors, basically their way of intro was, "Hi, I don't believe in sous vide cooking. I cook. I like to smell stuff," and you know that was a big stigma. And like anything else, you can cook something sous vide very poorly, or you can cook something sous vide that forms part of a multi-step recipe that comes across just as viscerally engaging as anything else. Same thing with robots. You could invent robot food that the point is to take humans completely out of the equation, or you could use robots as a way to give human beings more room to be creative, similar to how turn-by-turn navigation keeps our noses out of a map and allows us to look at all the flowers on the side of the road.
The seminar that you're talking at is Tuesday. What's it called and where is it?
So it's at the General Assembly in SF on Bush Street. Mm-hmm. It's called Articulate.
Articulate.
Yeah.
Okay. And people can attend that, get tickets to that?
I believe so. It's going to be a blast.
So what about our Creator I've read about, the first robotic restaurant in San Francisco?
Have you been?
No.
I they're just delicious. I mean, that's really
it's a burger place.
Yeah, it's a burger restaurant. I mean, and it's not meant to be a brasserie or a bistro. It's meant to be like a Shake Shack, like a good fast casual burger restaurant.
Where is it?
It is in Soma.
Market?
Yeah, it's like right in that market financial.
And so robots make the burgers.
Yeah, a big, very beautiful looking assembly line. Mm-hmm. It's not like a robot with a face and arms. It's like it looks very like
and tattoos.
Yeah, it's a very beautiful, sleek design. It looks very like Nordic design, sort of like a Rube Goldberg device, where there's like a conveyor and assembly line. And the only thing that matters to me is that that is one of the best fast casual burgers I've ever had, and like that's.
Yeah, it's worth going to.
Yeah, if you make food with taste in mind and like that's the goal, you can do it with a robot.
It's only open for lunch and like 3 or 4 days a week, and isn't that right?
I think it's opening more frequently now. And I mean, the last thing I'll say on the robotic side is we should also feel safe as humans, because it takes millions of dollars and years of development research just to make a robot that makes a good hamburger or scrambles a good egg. To make a robot that could do both of those things, we are so far away from being able to make that happen that there's a lot of room for food and robotics to knock out some straightforward tasks and do them really well. But we're not going to have no robot is going to get a Michelin star in the foreseeable future, just because the ability of humans to cook a lot of things very well is something that is still very human. So robots are still going to go piece by piece and be very meticulous, and you know, they're not coming for us.
And you wrote an article, The Uncanny Valley of Food?
Yeah, and that was actually for Wired.
For Wired
That came
magazine.
Out last year. Yeah, that wasn't actually about robotics. That was about like analog foods. So meat that is not made from meat, or
I mean, like the Impossible Burger,
things like that, or if things that are not plant based, things that are cultured, and the cells are grown individually, separate from a chicken or from a cow or from.
So how do you feel about that? About those kinds of foods?
It's a lofty goal.
Yeah.
I honestly, like we were talking about, some of the things that have been created, they can be really delicious. Mm-hmm. They can be incredible achievements. And off air, we were talking about Boca burgers and in the late 90s and black bean burgers. And those were something very different. And now we're getting close enough to the real thing that we're starting to trick and trickle in and trip over the same uncanny valley as you would see in a robot that becomes very close to being human, or a CGI character in a movie that is so close to being a human that you're put off by how close it comes, because it's not quite there, but it's close enough to make you care more than if it were a dinosaur. And with food, that's one of those things where our brains are trained on really reading closely in the details of food to make sure we're not going to die. Because before the FDA, there was just a bunch of people wandering around in an open plain, eating berries one by one and crossing their fingers.
Before we take our break, what other projects are you involved in at Pilot R&D?
Well, the biggest thing is we launched our own food brand over the last couple of years, which is called Render Food. And so we're collaborating with some of the best chefs in the country on bringing food to retail. And a couple Bay Area chefs like Stuart and Nicole at State Bird Provisions, we made a snack with them called State Bird Crunch. Nick Bala and Courtney Burns, who were the chefs of Bar Tartine, we actually did two beverage lines with them. One that's pickly, that's like a brine-based beverage that we use leftover pickle brine from Sonoma Brinery up in Healdsburg. Oh. And one called Wayla, which is a sparkling whey tonic, lightly sweetened fruity beverage that is part of the body of that beverage comes from repurposed dairy whey that we get from Point Reyes Creamery.
Oh my God.
Also up here.
When we come back, we'll touch on a few of your recent columns, your housemate columns in the San Francisco Chronicle. Dr. Ali Buzari joining Chef John Ash and me, Steve Garner, in the KSRO kitchen.
Loose ball to Thompson. Throw ahead, KD.
I have nothing to do with the Knicks.
One step and a right hand dunk for Durant and a timeout.
KSRO.
There's a better way to garden and landscape in Sonoma County. And it starts at a Better Way Produce and Nursery on Stony Point Road, just north of Todd in Santa Rosa.
Hi, Daniel R. Gibbs, botanical artist. I'm the award-winning resident licensed landscape designer and contractor. Our team has won first place 14 years in a row at the Sonoma County Fair's Hall of Flowers. And our garden, Coastal Charisma, won Best of Show 2018.
The nursery is ready for spring. There's spring color, bulbs, ferns, succulents, and houseplants all bursting with spring growth. Spruce up the yard or the house with flowers for Easter. Easter lilies and calla lilies are in stock now. Planning to landscape this spring or need a design for a rebuild? Ask Daniel about his design services and packages.
A Better Way Produce and Nursery, 3615 Stony Point Road, just north of Todd. A Better Way Produce and Nursery, open 7 days a week, 9 to 4:30.
Real estate in the North Bay is as diverse as its residents. From young families to retirees, you want a real estate professional that knows the region and can get you what you want with the least amount of hassle. Allison Norman of Keller Williams fits the bill.
Need to move mom and dad? Need to sell the house to pay for their care? With extensive experience in senior relocation, estate liquidation, trust and probate, I can help ease the strain of relocating an aging parent or settling an estate after the loss of a loved one. I'm connected with senior move managers and realtors locally and across the country for a smooth transition when relocating to a care facility or out of the area.
Allison is involved in giving back in our community too.
I've adopted a care, serve, give business practice, allowing me to give back to the communities I serve and the causes most important to my clients. Through Care, Serve, Give, I donate a charity you select at the close of every escrow.
Call Allison at 707-799-3617. Online at allisonnorman.kw.com.
KSRO, AM, FM, and online. Depend on it.
Before we let Dr. Buzari go, we want to touch on four of the columns that you've recently written for the Chronicle, going back from late 2018 to the present, in your Sunday Housemate columns. But before you do that, during the break, you mentioned you've got an article coming out on barbecue pretty soon.
Yeah, so I'm working on a article about barbecue for a new publication I haven't freelanced with before. It's a national science publication that is one of the big ones. That the premise is basically everybody who has these rabid wars, feuds over defending their home barbecue turf. By the way, Central Texas barbecue is the only true barbecue. everybody needs to calm down because it's actually all just sits on a spectrum. And like everything else in food, there's just a few fundamental patterns in nature that link together and unite Texas brisket with Carolina pork shoulder and all that sort of stuff.
Okay, that'll be fun. That'll be coming out in the next couple months.
Yep.
Okay, so Housemaid. Let's move to the one that came out in November last year from Squirrel Restaurant in Los Angeles, mm-hmm. Chef Jessica Koslow. What fascinated you about her restaurant? Why did you write this article?
This may be one of the best tasting restaurants in the United States. I lump Jessica's food in the same category as Stuart Nicole at State Bird Provisions and The Progress, where almost every single bite of anything I've ever had them make has been like make your eyes roll in the back of your head delicious. And one of the interesting things about Squirrel is it's largely a breakfast and brunch restaurant. Mm. And so it is part of this pantheon of great restaurants that are always in the conversation in the fancy trade magazines and people's top 10 lists and all that thing. But there's a weird tendency that we have to attribute this kind of food that Jessica and her crew cook at Squirrel to like comfort food. And she draws a lot of inspiration from childhood comforting foods. But what she is able to do is build in enough intrigue and contrast and differentiation and just shock and awe stimulus into every bite that you don't fall into the comfort food trap of giant bowl of mashed potatoes or porridge where every bite is the same and you're just able to tune out. You're still comforted and it's not food to make you feel uncomfortable, but it's food to make you feel comfortable and engaged. I don't know, like watching something really interesting while on a really comfortable couch.
And the recipes that you deciphered were the flat tots.
Which is basically a giant latke.
Giant mm-hmm. latke, okay. Shack peas, right.
So it's a play on shakshuka that they do with chickpeas and black-eyed peas and all kinds of legumes. That is insane. They basically make most of it in a smoker. They like make this sofrito with smoked. It's the cliche of layering flavors. They do it, and you can actually see it in the food.
You know what? One of the things you talk about there, and it's a kind of arcane idea, but I want you to talk about it if you want to, for a second. It was that whole idea about keeping the guest, the audience's attention, and that there's this tendency if things are so consistent that we quickly lose
interest. Every human being alive can see your own nose, and you probably haven't looked at it until I just said it for months. The reason that we can play tennis and drive a car and our nose doesn't get in the way is because it's consistent. Your brain is an incredible computer, but it's trained to tune out things that are consistent to pay attention to what's new. And so the only way to hold a diner's attention is to build in intrigue. So in their flat tots, they weave in threads of fermented horseradish. So every couple of bites, you like bite one, you say, oh, okay, now I'm back on, I'm back engaged.
The next one you wrote was quite remarkable in December of 18, Legend of the Chez Panisse Fruit Bowl. What intrigued you about this?
That one generated some online discussion, to say the least. So Chez Panisse is fascinating to me because it has been so prominent for so long and has never tried to figure into the conversation of pushing the envelope or innovation in the way that a lot of headline-grabbing restaurants tend to. And one of the things that is, I don't know, often quietly scoffed at in some types of kitchens is this fruit bowl, this iconic dessert dish that they do at Chez Panisse, where it's basically a bowl of very gently prepared and often just fresh fruit that's sometimes like dates and pomegranates in the winter or stone fruit in the summer, berries in the spring. And I wanted to talk about how this is not just fruit that you can get from the farmer's market. This is not just fruit that you can call the same farmers that Chez Panisse works with and get. There is so much attention to detail. There are individual trees on some of these farms where they get their persimmons, and only those trees will they take. And there is so much chemistry of what makes food great and this ever-changing, little dynamo going on inside of a piece of fruit. And they manipulate it so well. There is so much, this sounds crazy, but the point of the article is there is so much cooking that goes into them just handing you a bowl of fresh fruit. And it was a story that I really wanted to talk to
you about. So can you just briefly describe mm-hmm. what happens behind the scenes there, that whole idea of how the fruit is segregated yeah. according to its...
They have fruit condos mm-hmm. Where things are stored according to the metabolism of the fruit. So things that thrive with airflow are given airflow, things that will... lose a lot of enzymatic activity to generate aromas in refrigeration are always kept at room temperature. Things are shuffled back and forth. The different shifts of cooks that roll into the restaurant throughout the day leave each other incredibly precise, like playbook notes, where there will actually be notes that say this tray of these five nectarines will be ripe in 4 to 6 hours. Please serve tonight.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
Where we never have enough time with you. Never. I look at the clock and go, where did these 40 minutes go? So we don't have time to touch on B patisserie, but next time you come up, we've got to talk about the Queen Amon, the most remarkable pastry in the Bay Area.
Yeah. What
the Great Bakery.
Yeah.
And also your latest one, the Fatted Calf, which just came out March 31st in the Chronicle.
Absolutely.
Okay.
It's great. Well, the Fatted Calf one, I mean, it's like the, again, attention to detail. You describe in there the making of jerky and all of that kind of stuff, and kind of even what that's about.
And one 15-second detail I would be remiss to not mention on KSRO is that Fatted Calf is still doing their White Rock aged salumi, their sausage that they make with White Rock Cab Franc. White Rock is obviously one of the wineries that lost their winery during the Napa and Sonoma fires. And like 3 days after that happened, because their cellars were still intact, one of the owners of White Rock was texting Taylor at Fatted Calf saying, "Hey, are you good on wine? Do you need wine for the sausage?" Mm. I mean, there's such a commitment to making stuff tasty there, and that's a really fun story.
You're entertaining, and you always challenge our preconceptions mm-hmm. about mm-hmm. what we think about food. Thank you.
Thank you, guys. Always a pleasure.
Next week with the one, the only, Janet Fletcher.
That's right. What you going to talk about?
Wine Country Cheese.
Cheese.
That'll be fun. Chef John Ash, thanks. Listen next week for Garden Talk and the Good Food Hour, of course. Following the news, it's Clark Wolf at the table. This is KSRO.